Morning, Your Honors.
May it please the Court, John James from Potter, Anderson & Caroon, on behalf of the plaintiff appellee, cross-appellant E.I. DuPont and Demorest Company. And with me today, who will be arguing, is John Sylvester, who has been admitted pro hoc.
It's our custom to stand when you're introduced to the court. Welcome.
Who has been admitted pro hoc vice. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Kasperzak of Marks O'Neill, O'Brien & Courtney in Wilmington on behalf of Stonewall Insurance Company. With me today is my co-counsel, Virginia Seitz of the law firm of Sidley Austin, who will be arguing today. Also with me is William Sneed of Sidley Austin as well.
It would seem awkward to welcome you to Delaware, but welcome.
May it please the Court. As this Court will recall, this is an insurance coverage dispute between DuPont and Stonewall, one of DuPont's 1985 excess insurers, arising out of thousands of claims of property damage involving leaking and plumbing systems from the DuPont product Delrin. The question here is whether DuPont reaches Stonewall's excess coverage for 1985. The first issue is interpretation of the prior insurance and non-cumulation of liability clause in Stonewall's policy. It's in our brief at page 11 if the Court wants to follow along, since much of the discussion will involve the plain language of that clause. The clause provides that Stonewall's limits are reduced to the extent that, quote, any loss covered under Stonewall's policy is also covered in whole or in part by any other prior excess policy. The Superior Court found that the non-cumulation clause is clear and unambiguous, and the Delrin loss is covered in whole or in part by a prior excess policy.
Ms. Seitz, if I can just stop you there
Sure.
for a minute. That appears to be a major threshold issue, and it's raised in the cross appeal. If we were to find that clause in the policy is ambiguous, would the result be that the entire clause would be read in favor of coverage, as the other side contends?
No, we don't think so. Two reasons. First, the clause was drafted initially many, many years ago by insurance companies, but it was presented by DuPont with its broker as the policy that was then shopped among insurance companies for subscription. So we don't think that the same presumption in favor of the insured applies in those circumstances. And second, because as this Court has previously found, DuPont's a sophisticated consumer of insurance products, and we don't think a clause should be construed against the insurer in these sets of circumstances. So we don't think the context entitles them to the thumb on the scale in favor of their interpretation.
So if we were to agree with their interpretation, the result would be a triable issue?
The question would be, of course, on which aspect of the clause you found to be ambiguous and whether it was relevant. So, for example, if you found an ambiguity in the question whether payment would be required under prior excess policies in order to invoke this policy, in order to invoke the non-cumulation clause, rather, we would say to you that there was payment made and that very strong evidence of the fact of that coverage was provided and that payment was due under the clause can be found in the fact of prior payments of 1983 and 1984 excess insurers. And so that is an ambiguity that wouldn't be relevant here because payment was also made. So it would the question would turn on what precise ambiguity you found in the clause. And, of course, we think the Superior Court correctly found there was no ambiguity.
Well, if the ambiguity was relevant, then what would happen?
Then I believe you'd be correct that we'd have to I'd want to examine the particular one to be held to my answer, but I imagine there could be in some circumstances a triable issue. Of course, what we support here is the trial judge's finding that it's unambiguous. He did not, however, despite that finding, conclude that Stonewall's limits were reduced to zero. And this is where we believe the court erred. The Delrin loss is a single loss because it was covered in whole or in part by prior year's excess insurance. And the court's division of the Delrin loss into components of different losses is contrary to the language of the policy, the court's own prior rulings, and other case law interpreting the word loss in the context of non-cumulation clause enforcement. And I want to turn first to the language of the policy. If you look at the definition of ultimate net loss and of loss payable in the policy, you will see that the concept of loss is tied to the entire outlay of the insurer in connection with any particular occurrence. Now, the trial judge here found a single occurrence. And under the terms of the policy, if that is correct, then there is a single unified loss. As Chancellor Strine indicated in his recent decision in Viking Pump, quote, the inclusion of the non-cumulation provision means that an occurrence which is capable of triggering multiple policies must nevertheless be viewed as causing only a single indivisible injury. That is, a single loss. I want to point out, too, that the trial judge's treatment of the non-cumulation clause is inconsistent with the rest of its decisions in this matter. The trial judge says there's only one occurrence for all the years of this multi-year loss. If that's true, there can only be one loss. The trial judge says DuPont's entitled to only, DuPont receives one, to must pay one self-insured retention for all the multiple years of this loss. Again, if that's correct, there's only one loss, and the term loss can't be subdivided as the trial court did.
Now, one way to read your briefs is that your arguments are in the alternative, and that's clear in part. But as you know, DuPont says when you focus on occurrence and loss in a single incident or a single occurrence or loss with regard to this argument, it's inconsistent with your other argument that there were multiple occurrences, either two or 469,000.
As you say, these are alternative arguments. Our primary argument is that accepting the notion that there was one occurrence here, the non-cumulation clause must be interpreted as we do. In the alternative, if there are many, many multiple occurrences, then the self-insured retention should apply multiple times, and again, our coverage wouldn't be reached, our limits wouldn't be reached. So,
which goes back to your point that your contention is the Superior Court's opinion was inconsistent.
Internally inconsistent. It could, I would say opinions rather than one right. single opinion, because these were found in a series of decisions by the trial court. But it's not consistent to say there's one occurrence and to say that the entire loss is the result of one occurrence, and then simultaneously to subdivide the loss for purposes of the non-cumulation clause in the way that the trial court did. If you look, I want to go back to the language for a minute, at any loss covered here under, we do say that is a single Delrin loss. But at the very least, it must include all losses that trigger 1985 policies. So even if you wanted to subdivide the loss and say any loss covered here under only means losses that trigger the 1985 policy, Stonewall would still prevail because there are multiple millions of dollars of losses that triggered 1983, 1984, and 1985. And in that context, it must be that any loss here under, a loss that triggers the 1985 policy, is a loss within the meaning of the non-cumulation clause, and those losses are covered under prior policies, and Stonewall's limits should have been reduced by that amount.
Well, that certainly is a reasonable, tenable interpretation of the clause. It's not the only reasonable interpretation, is it?
We think it is the only reasonable interpretation of the clause. If you break the clause down term by term, I think it's very hard to read the phrase any loss covered hereunder to mean anything other than a loss that would trigger the 1985 policies that would also trigger including 83 and 84.
But the difficulty with your position is that it sweeps up the claims, the 1985 claims that would not have any predecessor coverage.
Well, it's
which,
not.
At least on its face, would not be subject to the non-cumulation clause.
Well, let me respectfully disagree. A loss that triggers 1985 as well as 84 and 83 is a loss covered in whole or in part by prior excess insurance. So we think by the plain...
But it isn't covered by prior excess insurance.
It is if a loss... I beg your pardon. It is if a loss, the loss is a single indivisible loss, as Chancellor Strine said in Viking Pump. It is only if you think that the word loss can be subdivided into annual components that the phrase any loss covered hereunder doesn't include 1985 losses. Now, you could say that, but you can't say loss can be subdivided in that way if you also say there's only a single occurrence, There's only one self-insured retention for all of these multiple years of loss, because if you're going to subdivide loss, then there should be an incurrence in each year of these losses, and there should have been a self-insured retention applied for each year of these
losses. But your side argues that there are multiple occurrences.
Our side argues in the alternative, if you reject our initial argument, that there are multiple occurrences.
But all of which would suggest that this clause is not crystal clear in space, such that all reasonable persons would agree on one meaning.
No, that would be a dispute about the ambiguity in the definition of occurrence, which is a different clause in the contract. If you disagree with us about what the plain meaning of the non-cumulation clause is, our alternate argument is based on the precise language of the Deamer clause in the occurrence definition, and that would not have an impact on the definition of the non-cumulation clause. These are strictly alternative arguments based on the meanings of different clauses.
And tell the court, if you would, with regard to the second issue, if we decide that this should not have been taken away from the jury, you go back and you have a jury trial on multiple occurrences, and they decide there were two, just to keep it simple, what happens then with regard to payments from your client?
The next steps that would have to be taken would involve additional fact-finding. You'd have to examine the 469,000 Delrin claims and determine which of the claims were attributable to the first cause.
So, as you know, DuPont takes the position in its brief that it's clear all claims have been paid for only one of those two occurrences. And I guess you're saying that's not clear on the record.
What the trial judge said was that the basis for that claim by DuPont was an uncross-examined affidavit by a single witness. And so that the trial judge declined to rely on that basis for ruling in favor of DuPont on that issue. So I think even the trial judge believed that there were unresolved issues of fact in connection with how many claims would be attributable to each cause. You know, for example, you can imagine that what you do is take the 469,000 instances of damage, and you might examine in what percentage of those claims were there water systems involved with no or low chlorine. And in those systems, you might assume that the damage was the result of the outside-in stress cracking as opposed to the inside-out degradation. So that would be the kind of issue that the trial court would have to examine on remand. Now, our alternative argument on occurrences relies on the language of the policy, which is what we call the Deamer Clause, that all such exposure to substantially the same general conditions existing at or emanating from one premises location should be deemed one occurrence. And we thought if that sentence were in play, the jury would have to decide whether the premise that was at issue was the single factory where Delrin emerged from, or whether it was the multiple premises, the homes, where the actual damage occurred. But one point I didn't think was sufficiently emphasized in our briefs that I wanted to make in connection with that argument is language that was not included in the Stonewall policy that was included in other DuPont policies, and that is the following sentence, which we think is very important, and you'll find at A313 of the record materials. All personal injury or property damage arising out of a common condition in goods or products manufactured, sold, or handled by this named insured shall be deemed one occurrence. So that is a strong indication, the presence of that language, that in a property products liability case like this one, you'd have only a single occurrence. That sentence, which is in the other DuPont policies, excess policies, is not in Stonewall's policy.
What is the consequence of that omission, and who bears the risk of that consequence, whatever it might be?
We think that in context, when you are looking at the entirety of a comprehensive excess insurance program, as you are here, that the omission of this clause from two of the policies, I believe, and its presence in all the others should be a strong indication that in our policy, you would not have a presumption that all damage from one product's liability case would be a single occurrence.
Is that irrespective of who drafted the clause?
Well, this drafting situation would be the same, I believe, as with the non-cumulation clause drafting, which is this is a provision, I think, that was drafted many years ago but then was shopped as part of the DuPont program of excess liability to the insurance market. So for the same reasons I articulated before, I don't think the thumb would be on the scale for DuPont's interpretation of this clause. But what we're arguing about in this instance is not so much about whether the language is ambiguous, but about whether under this language you have a fact issue which should have gone to the jury about how many premises there are.
And at the trial, before it became converted to a summary judgment proceeding, what was the menu of choices offered to the jury? Was it 469,000, but at the very least two occurrences?
Well, the mistrial occurred at the point at which our expert witness was on the stand, and our expert witness was testifying at that point about the two occurrence theory. I don't think it ever got to the point of closing or other arguments about other or other evidence that would have been put on. The trial judge did find that that it had not proceeded far enough to do anything other than enter a mistrial verdict, and then at a certain point, a Rule 50 motion, I think, was converted to summary judgment. So I don't think we really know the answer to that question yet, but we certainly would have argued, I think, on closing and as a matter of law, that the jury should have the question of how many occurrences there were under this clause. I want to get to my argument on pre-judgment interest if the court doesn't have further questions on this topic. In the contract setting, when a defendant has, without justification, refused to comply with a demand to pay that the contract requires it to fulfill, you have the running of prejudgment interest. We think in this case, the filing of the complaint cannot be deemed a demand that Stonewall pay, and it's because of the very unique circumstances in this particular case. In the complaint DuPont filed, it asked the court to declare DuPont's right to designate a period in which its insurers would be called upon to pay. It had not yet made that designation when it filed its initial complaint against all of the excess insurers. It was only in December 2001 when it amended its complaint that it made a designation, and at that point it designated the 1983 insurers, not the 1985 insurers. So there is a very long period of time in this case during which the 1985 insurers did not believe that they were going to be called upon by DuPont to pay the Delrin liability.
What is the triggering event? Is it the writing of a demand letter? Is it the filing of a complaint? What precisely are we supposed to focus?
Well, I believe, I'm relying mostly on this court, on the decision, in Citadel versus Roven, which indicates that it's a refusal to pay upon receiving a demand without justification. And so what I am raising to you as the justification for Stonewall's not immediate payment upon receiving the complaint in this case is that it was clear there was going to be a designation among the excess insurers for who was responsible for payment. And indeed, when that designation came, the 1983 insurers were designated, not the 1985 insurers. And it was not until, I believe, August of 2006 when DuPont made its all-sums demand on the 1985 insurers. And it's only at that point, we believe, that prejudgment interest should have begun to run against our client. And I'd like to reserve the balance of my time.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice and Justices of the Court. We've now passed the 10-year anniversary of this case, having been filed in December of 1999, and we're now down to the last insurance company, Stonewall Insurance Company, and the final coverage defenses that have been litigated, namely the non-cumulation of liability condition and the number of occurrences issue. And I'd like to first start with the non-cumulation of liability condition, a condition in Stonewall's policy. And by the way, just to address an issue that Ms. Seitz mentioned, that condition was drafted and included in a London insurance policy that was drafted in 1960, carried through to the 1971 umbrella form drafted by London underwriters, and Stonewall follows that London form completely. She talked a lot about a subscription policy that was shopped around in the market. That's not what we have here. Stonewall has incorporated and agreed to be bound by the terms of a London 71 umbrella form that was drafted entirely by London underwriters. DuPont had nothing to do with the drafting of the policies that are at issue here today.
Is it correct, as a matter of fact, that DuPont took that language and in marketing it, that language, in choosing its eventual insurers, did it in effect adopt that language as its own?
In higher layer policies in that year and in other years, there is a subscription form which Marsh & Mack, the broker, had insurers sign on to. But the testimony is, by their expert, Peter Wilson, is that that subscription form, so to speak, is almost entirely verbatim the London 71 umbrella form, which is the precise form that Stonewall adopted. There are some exceptions, but certainly with regard to the non-cumulation condition, it's the same exact verbatim language.
Well, maybe I didn't artfully ask my question. Let me try it again. When DuPont was looking for insurers, subscription or otherwise, did it say to the prospective insurers, this is language we would like you to price in offering your policy to us?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chief Justice, there's no evidence in the record on any of this. But with respect to that, the broker, Marsh & Mack, who is a dual agent of both the insurer and, in this case, DuPont, the policyholder, used that in going to the market to find coverage and to offer coverage to DuPont. So as to whether they were acting for DuPont in using the London 71 form or whether they're acting for the excess insurers, I think, is an issue in dispute.
I take your point.
Yeah. And as I read the briefs, there was some reference to these policies being described as manuscripts because they were negotiated. So just to follow up on the Chief Justice's question, whether this form was in there and, you know, its origin went back to 1960 or not, everything was negotiated in this policy, wasn't it?
No. The Stonewall policies, the first two layers of the 85-year, they're not subscription policies that were allegedly marketed. They adopted and incorporated by reference the London 71 umbrella form because their co-insurer in those two layers were the London underwriters. And they said, we will adopt the London underwriters form. London underwriters used their form. They didn't use any subscription policy that had some minor deviations. They insisted on using their form, and Stonewall adopted that and became a co-insurer in
I'm talking about the whole policy, independent of what a particular provision says. The whole policy was negotiated. Is that correct?
Well, no, for the first two layers of the 85-year, that was not a negotiated policy. That was a boilerplate form that London underwriters generated in 1971 that they sold throughout the North American market, and Stonewall became a co-insurer on that form. We didn't negotiate any word or period or comma of that form for Stonewall's policies.
Well, how do we get to this language Ms. Seitz talks about in the other excess policies that's different?
There is, with respect, there's no difference on the non-cumulation clause. It's verbatim. Right. With respect to the definition of occurrence, there is an additional sentence that was added at the end of the definition of occurrence that's sort of a belt and suspenders clarification that says that with respect to products liability cases, to the extent that there are mass product liability claims, if they all arise out of a common condition in products sold by DuPont, then they'll be deemed one occurrence. That's a clarification of what already was understood and existed with respect to the boilerplate form.
Who wanted that clarification?
Well, there's no evidence in the record in this case as to who wanted that clarification. They certainly didn't take any discovery on it, and I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, who, in your opinion, as an expert in this area, who benefited from the clarification in those other policies?
Both sides, because by aggregating all products liabilities into one occurrence, it benefits DuPont by helping us get through the $50 million self-insured retention, but it also benefits the insurers because if there's a massive catastrophe, they only have to pay one set of per occurrence limits in that year. And so it's something that both sides want. And certainly in the case of DuPont, which is a consumer products manufacturer, it would make our coverage illusory to suggest that every claim is a separate occurrence because, you know, especially with the high retentions and high limits that we have, the expectation was always between, certainly the reasonable expectation of DuPont was that all claims arising out of the same product in the same application would be aggregated together as a single occurrence.
Mr. Sylvester, let me ask you something that's very fundamental, at least to my understanding of the ambiguity issue. You and Ms. Seitz have basically proffered different scenarios about the manner in which the critical clauses were drafted. Your scenario, under your scenario, the consequence, assuming that we find ambiguity, would be that the thumb is on the scale in favor of DuPont.
Yes.
If Ms. Seitz's scenario were found to be the fact, do you agree with her that the thumb on the scale consequence would not attach?
No, I do not.
That is it legally significant which scenario is found to be the fact?
No, I do not. I don't think that Delaware has adopted the sophisticated policyholder exception to the rule of construing ambiguous policy language in favor of coverage, nor the other distinction. She said this was a subscription policy, but in fact Stonewall's policies were not.
So you're saying that under either scenario, if we were to find ambiguity, then your side wins?
Yes. That is right. And for Stonewall to win, they have to demonstrate that the non-cumulation clause, for example, has only one unambiguous meaning, and it means what they say it means, which when you think about what they say it means, quite frankly, we think that their interpretation is patently unreasonable. Not only did, and they don't mention it much in their briefs or in argument, but what they're saying and what they argued to the Superior Court is that if their limits are reduced down to zero because the two London layers that they co-insure equal $20 million worth of limits, and because we collected $20 million in settlement payments from prior years, they contend that that means their limits are reduced down to zero because this loss is covered in part by a prior year. They get to walk away. Well, wait a minute. Every single insurer in the 1985 year in a tower of coverage of $115 million could make that exact same argument, and they would say their limits are reduced down to zero.
And how did the Superior Court deal with the in part language?
Well, what the Superior Court said, to be consistent with its 2004 ruling, and we have to go back to that, in 2004 the court said that for claims-related expenses for this loss or this occurrence, they trigger policy years on a claim-by-claim basis because we have discrete information about each claim, and we know when it started and when the injury ended. And so there are some claims that involve installations in 1984 or 85 that can't trigger the 1983 year. And so it said allocating dollars on claims-related expenses, not non-claims-related expenses like defense costs, but on claims-related expenses, they'll be allocated on a claim-by-claim basis. And what the court said is for application of the non-cumulation clause, I'm going to be consistent with what I ruled in 2004, which is a ruling that Stonewall has never appealed, and I'm going to apply the non-cumulation clause in the same manner and take claims-related expenses and treat them on a claim-by-claim basis so that if they trigger a prior year, then the limits are reduced. But if they don't trigger a prior year, and if 1985 is the first year that they trigger, then I'm going to slot those in the 85 year. That's entirely consistent with his prior ruling, again, a ruling that's law of the case that Stonewall never appealed. So
where does that leave us with regard to the implications for the language in part? And do we then conclude, well, there's no in part?
There's no in part with regard to that portion of the loss which only triggers the 1985 year and which does not trigger any prior year. That's what the court held. That is one reasonable interpretation. DuPont offered several reasonable interpretations. Number one, as we had explained in our briefs, you know, the non-cumulation clause was never designed to address a legal scenario where you have continuous trigger over multiple consecutive years where the policyholder can choose on an all-sums basis 1 year to provide coverage. Their own expert acknowledged that that was the case. And so when we try to apply this non-cumulation clause 50 years after it was drafted.
I'm sorry, you're saying that the other side's expert testified about the underlying purpose of the clause, what the purpose was or what the purpose wasn't?
Well, Peter Wilson, who was a London underwriter, who they called as an expert, acknowledged that in 1960, when the non-cumulation clause was drafted, they didn't understand this concept that's now recognized in Delaware and in other courts in the United States, that a policyholder can choose on an all-sums basis any particular year to provide coverage for multi-year losses. And so it was not designed for this purpose, and they didn't have it within their contemplation.
Did he say it wasn't designed for this purpose? Or,
no, that's
that
my,
is that your spin
that's
on
my
what
spin
he said?
On it. He said okay. That they didn't contemplate or understand that legal scheme when he, in fact, or when the London underwriters put that into the policy. It was put into the policy to prevent a double recovery from a policyholder collecting twice from an insurer with respect to a single claim or loss. And certainly if you interpret the clause that way by its original intent, it wouldn't apply here because Stonewall hasn't paid anything on the $240 million worth of Delrin liabilities that we have incurred. In fact, if you look at the cases that they cite where the court does apply the non-cumulation clause, those are all situations where the insurance company has at least paid one set of limits and they don't want to pay a second one, and the court applies the language. Here, they're using it as an escape clause completely so that they have to pay nothing. It's the condition is turned into an exclusion, which it was never intended. Secondly, because we have the right under the all sums ruling of Hercules and other decisions of this court to pick the 1985 year, we say that there are no amounts due under prior years that would invoke the clause in the first place, and that any settlement payments that we receive from prior years, although they would go to reduce our ultimate net loss, as this court has affirmed the Superior Court's ruling in a prior appeal, they don't invoke the non-cumulation clause because they're not due. They're compromised settlement payments made by prior years, and so the clause shouldn't apply at all.
So you're saying the all sums, under the all sums doctrine, you can essentially read out the non-cumulation clause?
By picking the 1985 year, then there are not amounts due under prior year policies. And
is that a reasonable interpretation?
Well, I think it is because otherwise what they're suggesting is that we read out the all sums language of the policy by insisting that we go to the earliest year. They're saying that that's the way that the non-cumulation clause works, even though it doesn't say that. But they're saying, in essence, we have to go to the earliest year. We can't pick which year we want.
Is your contention that the policy is ambiguous on that particular point?
Absolutely, yes. And thirdly and finally, if there is going to be a reduction by the non-cumulation clause, if we are going to apply it based on settlement payments made in earlier years, if we're going to say that those are amounts due, when you have a tower of coverage in 1985 that's $115 million, if there's going to be a reduction in limits and every policy in that tower has the same non-cumulation clause, the reduction would be from the top down, not from the bottom up, so that if there is coverage to be afforded in the 85 year, it's going to be afforded by the first and second layer insurers that Stonewall participates in, and not, as they suggest, the fifth and sixth layer insurers. They're suggesting that this clause operates to deflect upward to the top of the tower coverage responsibility such that the fifth and sixth layer insurers, who've never been in this case, they've never brought them in as real parties in interest, that in essence this court should hold that the responsibility should be deflected up to the fifth or sixth layer insurers who have never even been heard in this case. And we suggest that is an absurd result and that Delaware law abhors absurd readings of policy provisions. I'd like to move on now to the number of occurrences issue and say that there is no genuine issue of material fact that the court thought needed to be tried to a jury. It was clear after the trial was near complete. There was a mistrial. One of the two witnesses that Stonewall offered, an expert, took ill on the stand, and he didn't finish describing the bases for his opinions, that there were two conditions giving rise to DuPont's Delrin liabilities. But President Judge Vaughn said, I'll accept his opinion as true for purposes of the summary judgment ruling. And I should also say, after the mistrial, Stonewall hired a substitute expert who was Dr. Broutman's assistant, Dr. Duvall. He gave the same opinion. He gave 2 days worth of deposition testimony. That was all put into the record. And then we went and argued on summary judgment, and the court said, you know, back in 2004, I thought DuPont had the better of the argument. Now that the record is complete as it's going to be, and I accept their argument that there may be two reasons why a fitting made of Delrin in a polybutylene system may leak, it doesn't matter as a matter of law because of Delaware law follows the majority law under the cause test.
Well, Mr. Sylvester, both sides agree, do they not, that in determining and in resolving the issue of whether or not there are multiple occurrences or a single occurrence, the cause test is the pole star. Is that right?
Yes.
And your side's view appears to be, and I mean it's a subtext, it's not something that seems to be explicitly argued, that in interpreting language of this kind, the court should avoid balkanizing the number of occurrences and should go up to the highest level of abstraction that makes sense in order to get down to a single cause. Is that right?
Yes, yes, in the sense that this is the policyholder's insurance policy, and the cause ought to be looked at from the perspective of the policyholder. The cause was the sale of a product for use in an application for which it was unsuitable. That is a single cause that resulted in all of the liabilities, and that is the perspective under Chief Justice's ruling when he was Vice Chancellor in the DuPont v. Admiral case. That was the focus on production and dispersal, not on how many injuries resulted.
But that's sort of a meta theory of interpretation that at least arguably gets to the result that you're arguing for. My question is that interpretation one that the courts have accepted directly or implicitly?
The courts around the country have accepted that, and we've cited throughout our brief that in a product manufacturer's situation, that the production of an unsuitable product for use in an application giving rise to multiple liabilities is a single occurrence. And if you look at the cases that they cite, they're either not product manufacturer cases that result in multiple occurrences, they're environmental cases, there are cases where there are multiple products involved, or there are cases where the court was actually trying to find coverage by a finding of multiple products.
Well, the other side's argument is that whatever merit that approach may have in the abstract, in this case it's tautological. That is, you abstract up to the point where the single cause is the occurrence is the production and distribution.
Well, that's their
defective product.
Their argument was that then any product liability has to be a single occurrence, and that's not true because products have different applications. Delrin products are used for hundreds of applications, and we have only talked about this particular single application resulting in the same failure, leaking, being a single occurrence. I'm into my rebuttal time. On the interest issue, I would just say that, as we said in our brief, the Superior Court ruled that in 1996 we had made a definite claim such that we satisfied the loss payable clause, which was one of their coverage defenses. And in light of that, and given that Stonewall has not appealed that decision, certainly by 1996 we had made a definite claim. By 1999, when we filed the suit, we certainly had made a demand sufficient to generate the accrual of interest. Thank you, Your Honors, and I'll come back for my last few seconds after Ms. Seitz is done.
Thank you. I just have a series of quick rebuttal points. The first thing I want to point out is when DuPont moved for summary judgment against the 1983 insurers, it stated the following in its summary judgment papers. Quote, the first paragraph of the non-accumulation clause suggests that the earliest policy year triggered by a given occurrence has primary responsibility to cover that occurrence, with subsequent policy years providing additional coverage if the first policy year does not have sufficient limits. And that's in the record at B0236. My second point would be the word loss is the entirety of the Delrin loss, not a portion of the Delrin loss. And there is no way to interpret the non-accumulation clause, as our opponents do, without subdividing loss in a way that's inconsistent with its use in the rest of the policy, and in the case law we cited in our brief, and is inconsistent with the court's prior, the trial superior court's prior opinions in this case. My third point would be that this clause is not a clause that was foisted on DuPont, and we lay out the history that explains that at pages 10 through 22 of our opening brief. The argument that there were no amounts due under the non-cumulation clause for purpose of this case is belied both by the fact that the policy itself indicates when amounts are due under a policy, not the insured selection of a year, and by the fact that more than $20 million were paid by 1983 and 1984 insurers, powerful evidence that they believe that amounts were due under the policy. Finally, not actually finally, but in response to my opponent's argument that the non-cumulation clause doesn't apply in instances where there are multiple excess insurers and so that the prior payment might not have been made by the same insurer, I just want to cite you to this court's opinion in Hercules, which applies the non-cumulation clause in the context of multiple insurers, as well as Chancellor Strine's opinion in Viking Pump, which explains why a non-cumulation clause applies in the context of multiple insurers. And I think his language in that opinion explaining why multiple insurers are covered by a non-cumulation clause is very instructive about why our theory of coverage and the application of the non-cumulation clause is correct. He states the excess...
You're out of time. We'll find the language.
Okay. Thank you.
Just briefly, with regard to the one argument by Ms. Seitz that in the 1983 year summary judgment motion, we suggested how the non-cumulation clause might work. The fact of the matter is the court said that you cannot put all claims into one occurrence. You have on the claims-related expenses, you have to look at them on a claim-by-claim basis. That's how we ruled on allocation. That is the law of this case that was not appealed, and that's why he's applying the non-cumulation clause in the same manner.
Thank you, counsel. My compliments to counsel on your excellent argument. This is not the easiest case I've seen in my years on the court, and the presentations were truly excellent and very much appreciated by the court. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.